Thursday, February the 23rd, I did that sinful thing, waste time. Mm-hmm. I threw away 10 good hours of my life, expecting to catch the 9 o'clock shuttle. Back to Washington, I woke up in the Carlisle at 7:30. Huge, fluffy white flakes were falling. The air was thick and the city was wrapped in a soft white shroud. Nevertheless, a phone call said the planes were flying, so the 9 o'clock would probably be the last. So I had breakfast and packed and dressed, said goodbye to Linda, and then came that inevitable call. The 9 o'clock plane's been canceled. No news on when there'll be other flights. Jerry had cannily made a reservation on the 11 o'clock train. So here was I, with more than 2 hours to use in New York. Too early to wake anybody up. And I couldn't really see Reese Playground in motion in a snowstorm. So I went to Bergdorf Goodman's, bought a pair of shoes, tried to go and see C.R. Smith's paintings, discovered it would be a close thing to make the 11 o'clock if I drove in that direction, and wound up frustrated and annoyed with myself in the dirty Pennsylvania station, 30 minutes before train time. I had a stateroom, and I remember when the height of romance to me was to take a train trip in a stateroom. The most privacy, the most isolation, the most time to myself. Also, I had a good book. The magic did not work. I did not feel pampered or excited or luxurious, and I got the rather frightened feeling that I might just be getting old or satiated. Hopefully, this dull mood was only because I had slept less than 6 hours last night and was too groggy to feel fully awake and not sleepy enough to go to sleep. I read fitfully, still the arrangement by Elia Kazan, reached Washington a little before 3. How many times I have come into this station with bottles of formula and babies and endless sacks and suitcases on 20 years of trips between Texas and Washington, but the last one was September of 58. Back at the White House, I simply went to bed, but still not to sleep. Studied the guest list and my introductions, dressed in my white satin, and at 6 o'clock was with Lyndon for the only real business of the day, the 5th reception for the members of the House. Bess and I have been concerned at the number of regrets. True, most of them say, out of town, frequently making a speech, are sick. Very few give no reason. And many say they hope they can be invited to another one of the parties. Nevertheless, it is a serious and unpleasant situation. I wonder if the erosion of the months of bad press has bred this sort of hostility for the Johnsons, or even a sort of disrespect for the White House, or whether the fact that we're having a series of 6 such parties has the opposite effect from what we intended and dims the luster of the congressional reception. Nevertheless, the guests who do come, almost all, seem thrilled and delighted. Tonight was especially good. After the receiving line in the green room and drinks in the blue room, Lyndon invited the men into the east room for their briefings. Secretary Rusk had returned, and Ramsey Clark was there, faithful Bob McNamara. I gathered up the ladies, and we went upstairs to the Queen's room, where our program was on the arts and the work of the National Council of Arts in being a sort of a midwife to the cultural explosion all over the land. I had looked with a bit of a jaundiced eye on this particular program, not quite sure how wide an appeal it would have. But then I hadn't counted on Agnes DeMille. I introduced our moderator, Roger Stevens, who made a brief, unimpassioned statement outlining the work of the National Council in its brief life. And then Father Hartke made a humorous, charming little talk that warmed up his audience. And then came the biggest surprise of any program I have had in the White House, Agnes DeMille. Midway during the speech, I realized that I was holding my breath practically. Every person was absolutely motionless, that we were really caught up in an emotional web that Miss DeMille's words were weaving. Later, Elspeth Rostow said, "She's a barn burner." And someone else said, "You can see that DeMille coming through. She's Cecil DeMille's niece." Well, it was wonderful, and I was so proud. In what seemed like a very few minutes, she covered the whole history of why Americans feel the way they do about art. That it is not very necessary, certainly not something the government ought to spend good tax money in huge sums to subsidize the way they do in Europe. It's rather the province of the rich, and better left to the ladies, not he-man stuff. And she traced this feeling to our Puritan ancestors and to the hard life the pioneers lived, carving out the virgin wilderness for their farms while they carried a rifle under one arm. And now here we have reached the age of affluence, and we have leisure time, which we're in mortal danger of frittering away with aimless driving and aimless TV shows, while there's all the richness of art waiting for us. As a nation, if we put our mind and our money into it, then there were questions. How can we begin exposing our children in elementary school to art galleries and symphonic music? Mrs. Main of Sioux City, Iowa, told how her hometown was one of the first in the United States to support its symphony from its municipal taxes. It works and they're proud of it now. She was one of the most attractive new members. I liked her very much. And Mrs. Bob Eckhart from Texas asked the question that made you feel the program had really stirred up some interest. What can we, as congressional wise, do about it? Roger Stevens said one thing is, you can inform yourself about what the National Council of Arts is doing, and here's a little brochure that tells everything, so that your husband and all the other congressmen you know can weigh how they feel about the importance of government help to the arts when the time comes for a further extension of the program. Figures about what this country spends on art and what West Germany, for instance, does had really been staggering. We are niggardly. Then I invited everyone to join the curator, Jim Ketchum, for a tour of the Lincoln Room and the Treaty Room and the Yellow Oval Room, especially the new members whom I'd introduced earlier in the evening. But many of the guests crowded around our speakers to congratulate and thank them and to ask more questions. It's a very pleasant feeling for a hostess to think a party is going. And as I moved with the ladies into the Lincoln Room, telling Mrs. Abernathy and Mrs. Whitten, who just finished the weddings of their own, about how we'd use this room for Lucy's bridesmaids to dress in, I could hear all around me the chatter of people who were thrilled, warmed, excited with the evening. It was a very pleasant feeling. I invited several of the new members and anyone who wished to go up into our end of the house, pointing out especially to them the paintings the White House has acquired since we've been here, and expressing for the 790th time the hope that we might someday get a John Singleton Copley. Who knows, somebody might know that somebody that might know somebody that might know somebody that might help bring here one of the paintings I'm after. Mrs. Pettis of California is one of the prettiest new members, and Nadine Eckhart, one of the liveliest. I realized that it was getting late and asked Jerry for an estimate from the East Room. He came back with a word that the president was speaking, and a good many people were asking questions, so I hopefully wrote a little note, folded it up, and said, Jerry, take this to the president. It worked. I'd hardly taken the next three people through the family dining room, pointing out Daniel Webster's sideboard, and Andrew Jackson's silver, and Lucy Johnson's wedding presents, one from the Trumans, before word came that the men were coming out, and we could join them in the dining room. It must have been a good briefing. I kept on hearing so from all the men. Nevertheless, I was glad I had sent the note, because everybody seemed as ravenous as I was, and I like to leave the audience a bit hungry while the performance is still at its top. I had a nice little talk with the Aspinalls. He's Mr. Conservation, and with the Glenn Cunninghams, he had the same operation on his throat that Lyndon had last September, and still speaks in a whisper. And Sam Gibbons, who's high up on the Poverty Committee. And Basil Whitener, who wanted to know when I was going campaigning with him again. Freddie and Olin Teague and Mab and Jim Wright. John Young was there without Jane, who's still recuperating from an operation. I steered our star, Agnes DeMille, into the Red Room once she had a plate full with some congenial company. And then steered Bill Wirtz and Jane in to join her. And later the Secretary of State. I wanted to make it a bright evening for her, too, and to show my appreciation for the vitality, the star quality, she had poured into our program. At 9:30, Lyndon went upstairs, and I soon followed. Each one of these had been different. It would be hard to choose the one I thought most outstanding. Tonight approached the bright salon I'd like to see it be. Later, Lyndon told me disquieting things about the men's briefing. For the first time, Dean Rusk, whom he always thinks is magnificent, he says he would give him an A time after time, did not do well. And Bob McNamara repeated himself once. They both looked tired, Lyndon thought. They're so indispensable, so wonderful. The very idea gives me a chill.